You have to spend some time unbecoming, rebelling and rejecting what you were. Not because it's bad, because actually that's what brought you to this junction in time and space, but also to acknowledge that it's okay to let things go and to reinvent in order to get to the next level. And for me, aligning with purpose is the difference between just running the tracks and being able to roam free.
Welcome to the Enrichment Project, Path to Purpose, recorded by the mad talent at Solid Gold Podcasts. It is a series of unfiltered and insightful conversations with some of the most remarkable purpose-driven human beings who have all achieved, created, inspired, triumphed, or challenged, and we have a great deal to learn from them. It is a quest to uncover and articulate the steps along the way to help you on your own journey of purpose. I am your host, Richard Wright, and I am delighted to have you with me. Thank you for the gift of your time. Let's dive straight in. I have with me in studio somebody who I've known for a very, very long time. In fact, back in primary school. And I haven't actually seen him for a number of years. We're going to catch up with you in this conversation, which I'm really looking forward to. But David Chislett is currently in the Netherlands. He's going to tell us all about himself, but he is a speaker. He's a writer. He's a trainer. Dave's done a number of very, very interesting things, from being a musician, also his published author, poet, and an artist at the same time. So an extremely interesting person who's got some very valuable insights into purpose and creativity. So David, welcome to the show.
Hi, Richard. Yeah, thanks for having me along. I'm really glad to be here.
Fabulous. David, I introduced you a little bit, but that's not a lot because that's kind of what you are, but not so much who you are. So who is David Chislett?
Right now, I'm a creativity activator. As you outlined, I've spent my entire adult life working in the creative and entertainment industries in various capacities at different times in my career. What I am now busy with is extracting the core of those experiences to be able to help other people to understand and activate their own creativity, mainly using the vehicles of public speaking and workshops and training. So what that basically means is helping people to understand the myths behind creativity and get over the blockages that a lot of us have from the way we were brought up and the way we were schooled and, in fact, the way we are managed at work, in order to get people onto a path that actually allows them to have real choices and options and therefore get what they really want out of life, in essence, you know, assisting people to figure that out and to step onto the road, not through maybe some of the more ordinary tools or techniques, but using actual creativity.
Sure. Sounds super interesting. And that makes perfect sense in terms of the fact that you are the co-founder of the Playful Creative Summit. Love that title. And I'm very interested to hear a little bit more about what exactly that thing is.
Well, the summit is a new event that I staged with my co-founder for the first time in April 2020. Mm-hmm. And we are, in fact, busy organizing the next one for 2021. Essentially, the summit is an online event for play and creativity professionals to share their insights, their knowledge, their tools, and their skills with anybody who's interested in play and creativity, which I think at this stage of the history of the human race should be pretty much everyone, because a lot of how we used to do what we used to do has just gone completely out the window. And I think, you know, working from home and just being fundamentally disconnected from all your habits has opened a lot of people's eyes to the idea that, hey, you know, there are other ways to do stuff. And in fact, some of them are quite cool and work pretty well. Yeah. So the summit, in coincidentally, really actually caters to that.
So a really good timing, actually, for all of that with this year. And you're right. Everything has been disrupted, turned around on its head, and we're looking at life completely differently. So great timing for you. Amazing. What I'd like to know is, so I know some of your journey, and you're going to share some of it during our conversation as well, because it's an unconventional and interesting journey. But at what point in time did you Do you think that you first felt, I'm following my purpose, or I have purpose, or this thing is my purpose?
That took me a very long time to get there. I turned 50 this year in 2020, and I think it only really happened to me about 3 or so years ago. And it was a process. It wasn't just a matter of waking up one morning going, oh, I need to teach the world to be more creative. It was, I'd just done so many things.
Yeah.
And, you know, while on the surface of things, that looks amazing. You know, I mean, you do the introduction, you say this band, poet, published author, book. It sounds amazing. But in actual fact, that makes one a very difficult proposition for people to get a handle on, to understand and to interact with. And so out of the frustration with all of these different handles that I had, I booked a clarity session with a friend of mine who lives in Amsterdam, who offers this as a service to entrepreneurs. Because as the sort of receptacle for all of those experiences and all of that knowledge, it was really hard for me to zoom out enough to see what the Dutch call the red threads, the things behind the things that connected everything. And it was during a course of that four-stage process with Beth that it became very clear that, yes, creativity is a massive red thread in my life. It runs through everything all the way back to, you know, childhood. But the thing that really blew me away was that the second red thread was helping people. My mother's a teacher. My father was a trainer. This was not a road I was going to walk down for various psychological reasons. And from my work in the music industry, I've learned to have quite a healthy distrust of charitable organizations and a percentage of the people who work for them. So this notion of being a teacher and a sharer and a helper was very foreign to me.
Mm.
But the logic was inescapable. And that's when I realized that actually my mission in life, my broader purpose was to utilize creativity to help people to change the world for a better place. I mean, I look at the way the world is and I think, well, it sucks. It's a mess. And there's so much obvious stuff that needs to change. And I want to be a part of that.
Yeah. So what's very interesting here is the number of conversations I've had with this project, where it's only into delving down into our identity. And as you said, those red threads to figure out who we are and why we are. And so much of that stuff isn't obvious. And something else you just pointed out there that I want to reiterate is the fact that very often another person, a third party, somebody outside of ourselves is necessary in terms of trying to help us to get to that place. So whether that's a mentor, a trainer, a clarity coach, it doesn't really matter. It's very hard to read the bottle, the label on the bottle, if you're looking at it from the inside. So, you know, getting somebody on the outside. So for those of you listening who are not as far along this path to where David is right now, I highly suggest that you'd find somebody who could perhaps help you to read the label on the bottle. But David, if you would humor me in going back to that childhood, because it was again, slightly unconventional and a little bit different. Tell us a little bit about what that was like and what it was like to be little David.
Well, I actually have really good memories of my childhood, but when I unpack the mechanics of it, there were obviously problematic things. I'm the youngest of five children, and my older sister is 10 years older than me, and the closest sibling is 5 years older than me,
sure.
Which had the effect of them essentially being adults when I was still very much a child. And I guess that, you know, in many ways that meant I kind of grew up alone. Both my parents worked, as you can imagine, in the 70s and 80s with such a big family. And I was left to my own devices, which was fantastic because it meant I got to do all sorts of crazy stuff that I really wasn't supposed to. And it certainly equipped me for the life of an entrepreneur in the future. If nothing else, I am problematically independent. I'm very attached to the idea of doing things my own way,
yeah.
No matter how good that way might turn out to be. But, you know, I grew up in the suburbs in the 70s and 80s in Johannesburg, South Africa, with, you know, acres of open space. At the bottom of our street when I was in primary school was literally a huge tract of open land filled with trees and grassland and rivers and crabs and poisonous snakes. And, you know, we used to have regular fights with the Afrikaans-speaking kids on the other side of the valley. I played a lot of sport. I did okay at school. You know, I was one of those kids who always had, based on his class interaction, David should be doing so much better at school. You know, I wasn't pushed at all ever during school, so I just had the liberty of kind of cherry picking, which is interesting because that feels like such a huge freedom. But as I got further down my educational career, I began to realize that that cherry picking implied a lot of limitations as well. You know, when you think about the subjects you choose, especially when you get to high school, has a large impact on how easily you can study what you may want to study. You know, and all of those stories about staying inside the lines and following the rules. So I definitely paid the price in a way for being so independent and following my own lights from such an early age. But that, again, is just one of those red threads. If I look back at my life and, you know, writing and communication is just railroad tracks that just disappear in one big straight line into my past.
Yeah.
And again, it wasn't until someone in my mid-30s said to me, turn around and look at where you've come from and then picture where that's going, that I suddenly realized, oh, yeah, okay, writing, communicating, speaking, this is always going to be part of my life. It's just, you know, you can't be so far down something that long and straight and just suddenly change direction. I mean, of course, you could change direction, but it's not going to happen overnight.
Yeah, for sure. You've made it this far, probably because the topic resonated with you. If you're wondering what the show is all about, listen to the trailer at the start of the season and find out how this show is going to help you along your own path to purpose. You've stumbled on a project that is all about purpose. Find out why the guests are all so vastly different, but yet all have so much in common. Hop on board this journey with me. Follow the Enrichment Project so that you don't miss out on a single episode and share it with, well, everyone. We are all looking for more meaning in our lives. If the show speaks to your identity or the identity of your brand, consider sponsoring a season. Let's make the circle bigger. Back to the episode and thanks for listening. So, I mean, my earliest recollection of you, I moved up from Cape Town in grade grade 7. This is grade 6, but my maths sucks, as you can tell. And playing sport against you and coming across this guy who was obviously extremely bright, who was obviously rebellious, super cool. You had this extremely confident air about you. And you were listening to music that the rest of us knew. It wasn't mainstream. And it was just like this super rad, cool guy who was very smart and just a little different to the rest of us. Not so mainstream. And you said just now about your adult life. You're working your adult life. And I thought to myself, okay, hold on 2 seconds. Adult day, you spend so much of your adult life playing and experimenting and doing stuff that isn't conventional. That's pretty rad.
Yeah. I mean, it's always interesting to hear people reflect back on your younger self because, I mean, the brutal truth is that until I completed my national service as a conscript of the SADF, I was probably the least self-confident young man you may ever have chosen to meet. But, you know, as the youngest of 5 siblings, I was very used to the company of adults and I was very precocious and very well read. So I could talk the talk, which made it appear that I was walking the walk, which is in essence the principle that I have applied for most of my life until such time as I was able to walk the walk.
Sure. So what happened then? So there's music, there's writing, there's poetry, there's all these creative pursuits. And I know you've mentioned to me that there was this moment where you didn't ever think that settling down, finding a life partner, having kids, starting a family was really ever going to happen to you, right?
Yeah. I mean, the way my older brother put it was that, you know, most people finish school and go to work really, really hard so that later they can play. And he was like, well, you know, you've just been playing, which means that sooner or later you're going to have to do an awful lot of really hard work, which, yeah, my brother's quite cynical. I think Look, I'm a middle-class white South African, so of course I'm enormously privileged. And part of what that privilege has afforded me were opportunities that I was able to exploit because, you know, I could string a sentence together and people mistake me for being an extremely confident and possibly therefore competent human being, no matter how much I feel. So what happened to me after school was that because of my interest in music, learned how to play bass and to scream into a microphone, joined a succession of bands, always ended up being the guy who phoned the venues and who spoke to the journalists, therefore became a band manager because I was believable, and therefore became a band promoter, and therefore became a music journalist, and therefore started a PR company specializing in entertainment, and therefore was able to move to London and work for a large events management company, working at large music festivals with international sponsors. And the way it kind of happened was that each opportunity which I took and ran with led me to another opportunity, which was fantastic, which is fantastic. But, and it's a huge but, I got to a junction in my life in my late 30s where I realized that in amidst this amazing list of achievements and experiences, there was nothing that I felt like was entirely my own. I always just felt like I happened to have been that guy who was in the right place at the right time and had enough energy to exploit something that pretty much just landed in my lap. I had never said, I want that thing, and gone out and got it.
Sure. That's a very, very interesting and poignant insight.
Yeah. It was at that point that I was like, okay, I've always wanted to be a writer. It's time I started putting things into projects, into getting published, into pushing that out into the world. And so that's the process that I started in 2008, which led to me publishing 3 books prior to to leaving South Africa at the beginning of 2013 to go and travel the world, and which is when all sorts of unexpected things had happened. So you see, this whole thing of not really feeling like I owned anything, I think was a huge part in me never being able to settle down.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that I never met wonderful, interesting women with whom that may have been or may not have been possible. It was more that I was just never in that place. And trust me, I got told that a lot. You know, the breakup talks were always the same. I just wasn't there because I wasn't doing what I wanted to do, as magnificent as it may have seemed from the outside.
Sure. So interesting how that happens to us, and we just take a path. And as much as, as you say, a lot of people would look on at your journey and call it exciting and romantic and amazing and playing and everything that everybody else might want, or so many people might want. So part of this purpose journey and uncovering the path to purpose is understanding the steps. And one of them is the fact that there's always a cost that comes along with this stuff, always. And it's whether you're willing to pay that cost or not. And as you've just very well explained, there's very definite cost that's come along in your own path to purpose. And I would imagine there was also a time when you left the one path and then started another, and you're kind of starting from scratch at something and starting at the bottom again.
Yeah. I mean, in 2008, when I made the decision to say, okay, I'm actually going to stop servicing the creativity and the creative ambitions of other people and start servicing my own, that was a massive change, because my network and the market I was tapped into understood me as a certain kind of human being. And all of a sudden I was coming up and going, no, actually I'm this kind of human being. And there was a lot of like, what, can you actually do that? Is that real? But that was okay. That was navigatable, because at least it was more or less in the ballpark. But then moving to the Netherlands and then suddenly being in a environment where I'm no longer a native speaker and my primary skills are linguistically related, and then asking yourself, what on earth am I going to do with my life here?
Yeah.
That was starting absolutely from scratch. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I spent 5 years teaching English whilst, you know, navigating a new culture and a new language and trying to figure out what on earth I could actually do here with what I have.
And how did you finally settle down, get married, have kids? Tell me about that story.
I have no idea. I left South Africa. I worked in a pub in the middle of nowhere, England, for about 4 months, lived in the roof with 2 crazy Scots guys, lost a lot of weight, really just stood very still for a while, and then took all the money I'd earned and caught a train to Paris and then another one to Barcelona and then back up through the whole of France to Champagne, through the Limoges, up to Normandy, into Belgium, and from Belgium into the Netherlands to go and visit my old schoolmate who actually you will remember from primary school days as well, Mr. Kivit, the man who taught me how to play guitar. And while I was in Amsterdam, I met this Dutch woman through another mutual acquaintance who happened to be in Amsterdam at the time. And it was just such an uncomplicated meeting. I was traveling, she's Dutch. The whole approach to relationships, sex, life-work balance, so totally different to what I was used to as a white middle-class South African, made a big impact on me. But then I took off because I had tickets and a job in Switzerland working in a ski shop. And it was only when my now wife, Iris, followed me to Switzerland for a visit that I was kind of like, oh, hang on a second. Yeah, the gap with very little contact and then seeing her again. And then she visited again. And then I visited in Amsterdam. And I was suddenly like, okay, all right. I'm not going to catch the Trans-Siberian Railway to Vladivostok. I'm not going to go and pick fruit in Australia. And I'm not going to hitchhike across the Pacific Ocean on tramp steamers until I get to South America. I'm going to move to Amsterdam and I'm going to be with this woman.
Wow.
And then she was like, well, I want to have kids. And I was like, I don't want to have kids. I don't want to have kids. I never wanted to have kids. What the hell? But by that stage, I had learned to value what I had found so much that I was pretty much actually open to sacrificing even that. What I thought up until then was a fairly deep-rooted identity perspective. I was willing to give that up as well. So yeah, here I am. Now I've got two. Woo-hoo!
Sure. I really love that. It's funny how as much as we might push against certain things, it's just always going to be part of our journey. And there it is, you know. And as you say, it's only looking back very often that we put the pieces together and understand how we landed up where we are. So a question I want to ask you is this. When you were growing up, when you were feeling like you grew up alone, when you felt like you were doing this thing called parenting yourself all by yourself, was there perhaps a certain person or at some point in time in your life when you didn't feel like you had the direction that you really wanted or you were struggling to figure out where this journey was going to go, what the purpose looked like, that there was a person that you most needed and that person was missing? Is that relatable?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, starting out in the music industry in South Africa, you know, which is so informal there because of, I mean, deliberate strategies during the apartheid era. And, you know, there's just no structure. There was no facility to learn. And there was a very dog-eat-dog atmosphere. No one was willing to teach you anything. I was privileged and lucky that three key individuals acted differently and gave me a leg up. But as a whole, it was a pretty unwelcoming place to start a career.
Mm.
So, yeah, and that feeling is kind of, you know, I've always done stuff that there was no career path for. You know, you start a job and you move up through the ranks and you get promoted or you get transferred, and it's all fairly predictable. Mm. And I've always wandered down little avenues where there was none of that. So, yeah, I'm very used to that feeling.
Yeah. So what's interesting for me, though, is that one of your red threads is this idea of being a helper, and that at always some point in time you're a helper, yet that was what you most needed for a lot of your life, was somebody to help you. And so you've become the person that you most needed, and you're calling that purpose. And that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I even used words very, very close to that when I wrote a book called 1212, A Step-by-Step Guide to the South African Music Industry. And the whole idea behind writing that book was like, I'm going to write the book that I really needed when I started managing bands. Because it didn't exist.
That's a remarkable thing about purpose. So what I also like, and I thank you that you're wearing, I was hoping that you were going to be wearing a branded t-shirt, is this concept of rebel, reject, and create. That first word,
yeah.
I mean, you're going to explain it nicely now. For those who are listening on a podcast, I'm really sorry you can't see David right now. For those of you who are watching on YouTube, David, please just stand up so we can see your t-shirt. There we go. So David, the one of the things about David that I just dig and I love the journey is, and I'll pop the website address below and his deets below. So you need to go and follow his journey. It'll be in the show notes. What I really dig is the creativity behind his branding and the creativity behind the clips and what he does. It's always really rad. But that first word, rebel, I mean, that is everything. I remember you and what you used to wear when you were a kid and the hairstyles, even now, this mohawk, you know, the rebel is really a part of your identity. And reject, again, is to me, it's just, I think one of the things, well, I guess what I'm trying to say is that the authenticity, nothing has changed there. So maybe you've grown up, you've become an adult in some ways. And I'm sorry about that, but you know, it's kind of bound to happen at some point in time. But what hasn't gone is the authenticity, is you, who you are, the identity of David. And I dig that. And I see that. And yeah. I think it's really, really cool. So please explain that rebel, reject, and create to us.
Right. So it's officially my slogan, rebel, reject, create. For me, it's a pathway to self-actualization and to freedom. And a lot of people are put off by it because they respond with quite a lot of negative connotations to the first two words, rebel and reject, which is funny because the original idea for that slogan came from a t-shirt that I used to have in the 90s, which comes from a movie from the 80s. And the t-shirt read, obey, conform, consume. If you were young during the 90s, there's no way you can have ever have missed seeing that somewhere or other. It was, even though the movie was a cult movie that no one ever saw, that payoff line was huge. And I'd had a t-shirt for ages. And of course, you know, it had fallen apart. So I wanted to make one for myself. But when I got down to sort of putting that together, I went, you know, obey, conform, consume. Yeah. You know, it's too negative. I understood where it was coming from, that the whole idea was to sort of ironically or sarcastically expose the hypocrisy behind the way we live. But that wasn't good enough for me anymore. I really wanted something that was active, that was positively oriented. So I quite simply asked myself, well, what is the opposite of obey? And of course, that's rebel, right? But I don't mean rebel as in, you know, become an anarchist and burn it all to the ground and break everything. I mean more rebel against your habits, rebel against your assumptions, rebel against the status quo, this idea that we're just doing things because we've always done them that way. And then that brought us onto conform. And I think also rejection is quite a powerful thing because quite often in accepting what is by and large, a very binary, polarized society, we unwittingly perpetuate an environment that doesn't admit to degrees, that doesn't admit to complexity or multitude of options. And I think it's really important to reject the binary, polarized environment that we are in. Because if your only options are yes or no, you don't really have a choice. And that for me is a massively problematic situation with the way our world works at the moment. So when you've done with rejecting the status quo and rebelling against your own programming, what's left? Well, you've got to step into the ambiguity. You've got to step into the unknown and you've got to create a new narrative. And it is only once you let go of the known that you can truly create. And that's the heart and the soul of the rebel, reject, create mantra. It's not an anarchist's war cry. It's more of an existential plea for meaning and for purpose.
So it's a path that a lot of people don't get to or don't cross in terms of this path to purpose. And that is the fact that there's always fear involved. And I think for a lot of people, it's this fear of stepping into something that is the unknown, stepping into this. If I'm going to say no to the programming, if I'm going to rebel against the conformity, we've all of us, and you perhaps were a little bit different that you got to cherry pick. But for most of us in our lives, we have had to conform to what our parents wanted for us. And when we did certain things, they said, oh, well done, Dave. Good boy. We're really, really proud of you when you do that. That's amazing. Do more of that. And then we do things that they don't like. And they're like, no, Dave, don't ever do that again. In fact, go to your room and you know, make sure you don't even stop thinking like that even. Don't be that person. You can come out of your room when you stop being that person, because that's not who we are. Then you go to university and who do you have to become to attract the partner? And that's the conventional route, right? And it's very hard for most people to step away from that habitual way of thinking, from that comfort zone, because that's really what it is. It might not be that amazing, but it's comfortable. It's what I know. It's all I know. And now, David, you're asking me to step away from that into something completely foreign, unknown, and create. Create what?
Yes. Whatever you want. You know, because that's the thing, right? By saying no to those things, you're immediately saying no to a whole bunch of things. And the truth is that that is not true. So I think this is what the advantage is of having been, you know, artistically creative from a very early age. So that you begin to understand that when you don't accept something, you don't say yes or no, you go maybe, and you spend some time out in the darkness, in the ambiguity, you begin to see that actually it's complex. There are more options than the binary choice that you were presented with. And you get more comfortable with hanging out in that space until you can figure it out, until you can connect some of those, your variety of options together to come up with a new kind of an answer. I think one of the reasons why creativity is so, you know, scary, intimidating for a lot of people is that we're not used to hanging out in a space where there's no clear answer, where there is no real yes or no. Mm. There's not lots of maybes and possibilities and you know, a lot more moving parts than we bargained for. And what's amazing about this is that that's exactly what Newtonian science tells us about the world, is that there's always a smaller particle. The longer you look at something, the deeper you drill, the more complex it gets. But if you start looking at the world as on a more quantum level, you begin to realize that all of these things are interconnected and they all move in systems which all join up, which all flow into one another. Mm. And there is no discrete yes or no. There's just a continuum of an open-ended system that is interacting with the next open-ended system, which is resulting in certain things. And so you don't have to change the pieces. You don't have to deny the discrete things. All you have to do is act differently in the system, and the process will deliver a different answer. And that's what artists instinctively know. But because of the way we're educated, because of the way we're socialized, most people don't instinctively know it, and it terrifies the hell out of us.
Exactly right. So there are three things I want to mention in terms of, or just perhaps point out. And the first thing is that 100%, we are... You know, even our entire education system is on, there's a right answer and there's a wrong answer. And if you get the wrong answer, you're punished. And if you get the right answer, you're praised. And so, you know, it's a finite thing of, and that's obviously what we look for going forward in life. So totally agree with you. Then in terms of the complexity of life, and that's something I've always really enjoyed, is this idea of simplicity, complexity, simplicity. When we first go to school and the teacher says, David, 1 + 1 = 2, you're like, sorry, just run that one, what, how? And then, you know, we get it and like, okay, so this thing was complex and now it's simple, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. And that's anything. There's this mess. There's this hard part of complexity before we can make it simple again. And I think it's the same with purpose. Is we're doing all these, it's a simple thing, right? We make it complex because of everything, you know, the wheels and everything, the gears that are turning in our lives. And then we look back and we're like, oh, that was actually pretty simple. There's a red thread. Look at that. And I quite dig that, right? The third thing is, in terms of unraveling the complexity and getting into that, I think one of the quotes that has always resonated with me is Oliver Wendell Holmes. And I know if it written in today's time, it would have been a person's mind, but he wrote, a man's mind, we'll just say person, a person's mind wrapped around a new idea can never return to its original dimensions. And I dig that. So it's the tiniest little thing that changes. It's that tiny little thing that changes and everything changes after that. And perhaps that's a part of the creativity journey, is just introducing tiny little things that don't have to mean much. It doesn't have to become something huge. It's just the start of something that changes. So what I want to know is, how do you do this creativity thing? How do you take us mere mortals who are trudging through life and inject or help us to discover this creativity and make something more?
All right. Pocket course. It goes like this. creative thought requires a very specific state of mind. There are four conditions for that specific state of mind. Number one is you need interior quiet. You can't be thinking about too much stuff. You need to be having that sort of almost dreamlike, drifting kind of state of mind to get into a creative state. Number two, you need to be inward looking. All right. So not thinking about consequences, about what other people will think, just busy about with what you know, with what you're feeling and what your intention is. Number three, you need to be slightly happy. In other words, not actively unhappy. You know, so slightly happy doesn't mean, you know, swinging from the chandeliers. It's just, you know, maybe contentment would be a better word. And number four, you must not try too hard. Because when you try too hard, you think too much, you look outwards, you're no longer particularly happy, you start to experience anxiety, and it all goes out the window. Now, if you want to get into that state of mind, which you, everyone listening to, gets into every single day when you get into the shower, when you do something that you've been doing tens of thousands of times that you don't have to consciously think about, you know, when your mind just slips its moorings while your body does something that it knows how to do really, really well. You know, it's not a coincidence that people report getting their best ideas while walking the dog, doing the ironing, having a shower, you know, working out in the gym, because they all meet the primary four pillars of the creative mindset. Now, if you want to be more creative for a particular purpose, to create a particular product or for a particular goal, what this means is that you've now got to actively and consciously create and hold space where this can take place. This runs counter to the primary myths of creativity, which state that inspiration strikes and it's got nothing to do with you. It comes from without. Mm. But in actual fact, it comes from within. And the aha moments that we experience on a neurological level fire off a very small number of neurons, effectively, you know, maybe 10,000 or so. Whereas the amount of neurons that go off when you're trying to decide whether you're going to have chicken or beef number in the hundreds of thousands. So if you're not in a quiet mental state, which is slightly inwardly looking, you will literally not hear the aha moment go off in your head. So you've got to hold the space and then you've got to repeat, you know, it starts to drift uncomfortably close to Gladwell's idea of 10,000 hours. But when you practice something, you do get better at it. You know, meditation, yoga all get a lot easier the more you do it. Mm. So if you are regularly able to hold 15 minutes, 30 minutes a day open for creative mind state stuff, you will inevitably start to have realizations and aha moments and come up with ideas. Those are the first two most easy steps that everyone can undertake as of now.
So for me, it's interesting how just penny drops, you know, it's something that I think we all intuitively, instinctively know, but just don't identify with and don't realize that that is what it is and then don't do it. So my most creative times are spent either on the bicycle or running or in the swimming pool when I can't even speak. I'm just, you know, it's the water in my ears and it's always in training. And I love that. I call it my church almost because I'm not a particularly spiritual person or religious person. And that is my church. That's when I go and do my filing and come up with ideas. And so I'm really relating to what you're saying. But I normally in those moments, have got an idea or something that I know I need to come up with or a talk or a topic or a video I'm going to put together. So I normally go in with something and then produce it in that moment and come out the other side with something. So immediately the first thought is, okay, what if I don't go in with anything? What if I don't know what I'm supposed to be thinking about? What then?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, you've embarked on level two, you know, introducing intentionality into entering into the creative mind state is crucial for getting desired results. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you go for the 20-hour swim like you do, you lunatic, you know, because with a particular problem in mind. What'll happen is if you don't set a particular problem is that whatever last problem you'll wrestle with, you'll suddenly get an answer to. Mm. And I think this is why people often think like ideas and creativity is magic, because you've forgotten you were wrestling with trying to figure out how to fix this thing at home or sort out this business problem at work. And then suddenly when you're doing something totally random and you haven't even consciously thought about this issue for an extended period of time, your unconscious brain has been gnawing at it like a dog with a very big bone the entire time.
Mm.
And the big difference between conscious processing and unconscious processing is that conscious processing deals with a tiny fragment of information compared to what your unconscious does. So it takes long because your unconscious literally rifles through the drawers of your memory like a robber on Christmas Eve, comparing and sorting and contrasting what's going on in your head with what it's already got to an alarming degree. And it just jams stuff together at will, at random. And that's why your dreams are so psychedelic, because your brain's doing what it's doing and it's just comparing stuff. Whereas when you're awake, you're obeying the rules of logic, of rational thought, of civilized thought. Oh, we can't think like that. And you're censoring the process. So you will get quite predictable answers. And so what your unconscious is up to is not civilized, it's not predictable, and is wonderful and quite magical. Mm. You jump in the pool thinking, oof, how am I going to tailor what I'm doing for this particular tricky client? Whereas, you know, next week, if you jump in the pool and you don't have a client coming up, you're going to come out of the pool with an answer to something else that you were wrestling with that you'd forgotten about.
Yeah. Thank you. And you're 100% right. That's exactly what happens. In fact, one of my scariest moments. So I've spent some time with a number of therapists or psychologists over all my years, and none of them have really been able to help, but that's just what it is. But there was one reflective psychology, right? And I would go in there, and I was vastly studying psychology, and part of the courses we needed to go and see various people. And this person said nothing to me, nothing at all. I'd walk in there and it was just hello, and there was a greeting. That was it. And I'm like, okay, what are we going to talk about? And I silence, whatever you want to talk about. And we're like, there's nothing I want to talk about. No problem. We'll just sit in silence and wait. And it was so uncomfortable, but it's exactly what you're talking about. Always that stuff came bubbling up. The stuff you needed to talk about came bubbling up. And those sessions were, they were hectic because some of the stuff that came up is not the stuff you really want to talk about intentionally. It's as exactly as you've mentioned. It's that subconscious mind. So yeah, I totally get that. It can be quite scary and it can be quite overwhelming. And, I guess that's exactly why it's so important to have somebody help you through this.
Yeah, in this instance, that is me. Because I think once you start becoming creatively activated, it will have an impact on the rest of your life. It won't just help you be better at work. I love your quote, because now I understand where this favorite saying of mine comes from. You can't unknow what you know. So once you switch the machine on, that's it, man. It's going to start, and because it runs on a very subconscious engine, it's going to start spilling out all over, mostly for the good, but it can be very disconcerting, you know, especially if suddenly you start realizing that, maybe you shouldn't be doing this job after all, or whatever, you know, your brain can come up with all sorts of unexpected answers. And I think your therapist was very wise because, you know, what they're doing is that you are also a very verbally intelligent human being. And therefore, you use that to run rings around people and not really talk about what's going on in your head. And by taking that away from you, there.
No, that is exactly right. And I've always said, you know, you need to, once you've been to a couple of therapists or psychologists, you begin to understand quite quickly what you can say safely and how to get away with things and, you know, exactly how to make it less uncomfortable. So exactly right. So part of this purpose journey and I really enjoy the slant in terms of getting into a creative space, and that will somehow help you along your path to purpose. And exactly what you're saying right now, it isn't this idea of what is the target? What am I aiming at? What is this big thing I want to do or become? It's just getting in touch with yourself and just getting in touch with what's going on inside you and becoming creative with your own being and your own thoughts. And it's those small little ideas that get you there. But the one thing that I found extremely or vitally critically important is you have to do the work in unbecoming. You have to go and get in touch with those gnarly, ugly parts that you have avoided your whole life and that you, places you don't want to go, and start understanding that there are things about you that you might not like, and that's okay. And there are things about you that are not necessarily fabulous, and that's equally okay. And that's such an essential part. So exactly as you've said, that for some people, it might be the acknowledgement or the understanding that, oh my goodness, I'm in the wrong job. And then it's immediately, oh, well, how am I going to get paid? How am I going to get, you know, financed if this is where I'm going to go now? How does that? And then that immediate fear becomes the roadblock that stops us from taking the journey further. Have you, you know, got any advice that you would like to give people from that point of view?
I think the current obsession in coach talk and in self-development land with purpose can be misleading, because we are presented with a cookie cutter set of tools and desired outcomes. And as far as I'm concerned, purpose is entirely personal and unique. And this is why I approach purpose from the corner of creativity, because, you know, one of the definitions of creativity is that it results in something which is unique or original and has value, which is a definition that I reject, because A, there is nothing new under the sun, like actually totally original or unique. Two very misused words, actually. But more importantly, of value to who? You know, purpose doesn't need to mean becoming Bill Gates and starting the foundation and inventing Microsoft. All it means is that you are working towards an expression of yourself that has value to you. And it's actually up to you to create that. And yeah, Richard, you're right. And it, again, it links beautifully back to my rebel, reject, create mantra. Thank you for pointing that out. Is that you have to spend some time unbecoming, rebelling and rejecting what you were. Not because it's bad, because actually that's what brought you to this junction in time and space, but also to acknowledge that it's okay to let things go and to reinvent in order to get to the next level. And for me, aligning with purpose is the difference between just running the tracks and being able to roam free. It allows me to make the decisions between the opportunities that present themselves that keep my energy pointing in one direction instead of dispersing it all over the place. But it's different for everybody. And that's why I think it is so important that we, in fact, invent our own purpose and resist the cookie cutter solutions that that pop culture are presenting to us every day.
So I think that you have stumbled on something in terms of your own life that is extremely powerful, and your desire to help other people to find that creative inside person is just something remarkable and a gift to the world. So kudos to you and congrats for getting off your own tracks and roaming in the great beyond on the other side of that. And just in closing, David, the last question I want to ask you is, on that day when you are no longer here to so eloquently speak for yourself, and somebody else is doing a pretty crappy job on your behalf, what would you most want them to celebrate your life for, or your existence? What would that be?
Yeah. I think it would be that, I think the biggest compliment that anyone could ever say about me would be that I never stood still. I was always moving on to the next thing, that I was always committed to growing and changing and seeing what lay beyond the next horizon. And, you know, mostly intellectual, internal horizons. But I would be pretty pleased if that's what people ended up remembering.
Fabulous. Well, I think I can add to that and say that the legacy that you are creating and leaving behind is definitely helping people to become more creative in their lives and become better versions of themselves. And I think that's pretty remarkable. And that's leaving a massive legacy on its own. So, David, thank you so, so much for your time. Thank you for being on the show. Thank you for your insights. Thank you for the unconventional human being that is you, the force of nature that is David Chislett. I'm grateful to be a part of that journey, and I look forward to what's coming with a great excitement. Thank you so much.
Right back at you, Richard. Thanks so much for having me here. It's been an absolute privilege and a pleasure. Awesome. Thank you.
Cheers. Thank you for staying right to the end of the episode and for joining me on the Enrichment Project. Before you go, please share this episode with your friends and your colleagues. They will thank you, I'm sure. Remember that you can catch each Path to Purpose episode by watching on YouTube, or if you prefer, on your favorite podcast app. The link to my book, The Power of Purpose, is in the show notes. Please go and check it out. It's a rad account of my own story of purpose and resilience and my fight against brain cancer. I finished 6 full Ironman events, a number of multi-stage mountain bike races, 9 Ironman 70.3 races, including the Ironman World Championships, and a bunch of other endurance events, all with stage 4 brain cancer, because I wanted it that badly and getting to the finish line meant that much to me. As a professional inspirational speaker, business and life coach, author and storyteller, I'd love to add more value to you or your organization. Please find more details on my website, iamrichardwright.com, and book me today for a live or virtual keynote, a masterclass, workshop or coaching session, or please follow my journey on Facebook, I Am Richard Wright, Twitter, The Wright Rich, Instagram, I Am Richard Wright, or on LinkedIn. I'd love the opportunity to enrich your team. Thank you to the professional crew at Solid Gold Podcasts for the support, the talent, and the mad skills. And to Anna Hick for her creativity and genius video magic. Thank you. You all rock.